timing is everything. Charmers must know when to hibernate and when the times are ripe for their persuasive powers. Known for their flexibility, they should sometimes be flexible enough to act inflexibly. Zhou Enlai, the consummate chameleon, could play the hardcore communist when it suited him. Never become the slave to your own powers of charm. Keep it under control. Something you can turn off and on at will. In conclusion, here are some further reflections on the charmer. A quote from Samuel Butler. Birds are taken with pipes that imitate their own voices, and men with those sayings that are most agreeable to their own opinions. From Ovid's The Art of Love. Go with the bow, you'll bend it. Use brute force, it'll snap. Go with the current, that's how to swim across rivers. Fighting upstream's no good. Go easy with lions or tigers if you aim to tame them. The bull gets inured to the plow by slow degrees, so yield if she shows resistance. That way you'll win in the end. Just be sure to play the part she allots you. Censure the things she censures. Endorse her endorsements. Echo her every word. Pro or con, and laugh whenever she laughs. Remember, if she weeps, to weep too. Take your cue from her every expression. Suppose she's playing a board game. Then throw the dice carelessly. Move your pieces all wrong. Don't jib at a slavish task like holding her mirror. Slavish or not, such attentions please. A quote from Disraeli by André Marois. Disraeli was asked to dinner and came in green velvet trousers with a canary waistcoat, buckle shoes, and lace cuffs. His appearance at first proved disquieting, but on leaving the table, the guests remarked to each other that the wittiest talker at the luncheon party was the man in the yellow waistcoat. Benjamin had made great advances in social conversation since the days of Murray's dinners. Faithful to his method, he noticed the stages. Do not talk too much at present. Do not try to talk. But whenever you speak, speak with self-possession. Speak in a subdued tone, and always look at the person whom you are addressing. Before one can engage in general conversation with any effect, there is a certain acquaintance with trifling but amusing subjects which must be first attained. You will soon pick up sufficient by listening and observing. Never argue. In society, nothing must be discussed. Give only results. If any person differ from you, bow and turn the conversation. In society, never think, always be on the watch, or you will miss many opportunities and say many disagreeable things. Talk to women. Talk to women as much as you can. This is the best school. This is the way to gain fluency, because you need not care what you say, and had better not be sensible. They, too, will rally you on many points, and as they are women, you will not be offended. Nothing is of so much importance and of so much use to a young man entering life as to be well criticized by women. A quote by Albert Camus. You know what charm is. A way of getting the answer yes, without having asked any clear question. A quote from Gabriel Tarde's L'Opinion et la Foule. A speech that carries its audience along with it and is applauded is often less suggestive simply because it is clear that it sets out to be persuasive. People talking together influence each other in close proximity by means of the tone of voice they adopt and the way they look at each other, and not only by the kind of language they use. We are right to call a good conversationalist a charmer in the magical sense of the word. A quote from Arthur Schopenhauer's Counsels and Maxims. Wax, a substance naturally hard and brittle, can be made soft by the application of a little warmth, so that it will take any shape you please. In the same way, by being polite and friendly, you can make people pliable and obliging, even though they are apt to be crabbed and malevolent. Hence, politeness is to human nature what warmth is to wax. A quote by Benjamin Disraeli. Never explain, never complain. The charismatic. Charisma is a presence that excites us. It comes from an inner quality, self-confidence, sexual energy, sense of purpose, contentment, that most people lack and want. This quality radiates outward, permeating the gestures of charismatics, making them seem extraordinary and superior, and making us imagine there is more to them than meets the eye. They are gods, saints, stars. Charismatics can learn to heighten their charisma with a piercing gaze, fiery oratory, an air of mystery. They can seduce on a grand scale. Learn to create the charismatic illusion by radiating intensity while remaining detached. Charisma and seduction. Charisma is seduction on a mass level. Charismatics make crowds of people fall in love with them, then lead them along. The process of making them fall in love is simple and follows a path similar to that of a one-on-one seduction. Charismatics have certain qualities that are powerfully attractive and that make them stand out. This could be their self-belief, their boldness, their serenity. They keep the source of these qualities mysterious. They don't explain where their confidence or contentment comes from, but it can be felt by everyone. It radiates outward without the appearance of conscious effort. The face of the charismatic is usually animated, full of energy, desire, alertness. The look of a lover, one that is instantly appealing, even vaguely sexual. We happily follow charismatics because we like to be led, particularly by people who promise adventure or prosperity. We lose ourselves in their cause, become emotionally attached to them, feel more alive by believing in them. We fall in love. Charisma plays on repressed sexuality, creates an erotic charge. Yet the origins of the word lie not in sexuality, but in religion. And religion remains deeply embedded in modern charisma. Thousands of years ago, people believed in gods and spirits, but few could ever say that they had witnessed a miracle, a physical demonstration of divine power. A man, however, who seemed possessed by a divine spirit, speaking in tongues, ecstatic raptures, the expression of intense visions, would stand out as one whom the gods had singled out. And this man, a priest or a prophet, gained great power over others. What made the Hebrews believe in Moses, follow him out of Egypt, and remain loyal to him despite their endless wandering in the desert? The look in his eye, his inspired and inspiring words, the face that literally glowed when he came down from Mount Sinai, all these things gave him the appearance of having direct communication with God, and were the source of his authority. And these were what was meant by charisma, a Greek word referring to prophets and to Christ himself. In early Christianity, charisma was a gift or talent vouchsafed by God's grace and revealing his presence. Most of the great religions were founded by a charismatic, a person who physically displayed the signs of God's favor. Over the years, the world became more rational. Eventually, people came to hold power not by divine right, but because they won votes, or proved their competence. The great early 20th century German sociologist Max Weber, however, noticed that despite our supposed progress, there were more charismatics than ever. What characterized a modern charismatic, according to Weber, was the appearance of an extraordinary quality in their character, the equivalent of a sign of God's favor. How else to explain the power of a Robespierre or a Lenin? More than anything, it was the force of their magnetic personalities that made these men stand out and was the source of their power. They did not speak of God, but of a great cause, visions of future society. Their appeal was emotional. They seemed possessed. And their audiences reacted as euphorically as earlier audiences had to a prophet. When Lenin died in 1924, a cult formed around his memory, transforming the communist leader into a deity. Today, anyone who has presence, who attracts attention when he or she enters a room, is said to possess charisma. But even these less exalted types reveal a trace of the quality suggested by the word's original meaning. Their charisma is mysterious and inexplicable, never obvious. They have an unusual confidence. They have a gift, often a smoothness with language, and that makes them stand out from the crowd. They express a vision. We may not realize it, but in their presence, we have a kind of religious experience. We believe in these people without having any rational evidence for doing so. When trying to concoct an effect of charisma, never forget the religious source of its power. You must radiate an inward quality that has a saintly or spiritual edge to it. Your eyes must glow with the fire of a prophet. Your charisma must seem natural, as if it came from something mysteriously beyond your control, a gift of the gods. In our rational, disenchanted world, people crave a religious experience, particularly on a group level. Any sign of charisma plays to this desire to believe in something. And there is nothing more seductive than giving people something to believe in and follow. Charisma must seem mystical. But that doesn't mean you cannot learn certain tricks that will enhance the charisma you already possess, or will give you the outward appearance of it. The following are basic qualities that will help create the illusion of charisma. Purpose. If people believe you have a plan, that you know where you're going, they will follow you instinctively. The direction doesn't matter. Pick a cause, an ideal, a vision, and show that you will not sway from your goal. People will imagine that your confidence comes from something real, just as the ancient Hebrews believed Moses was in communion with God, simply because he showed the outward signs. Purposefulness is doubly charismatic in times of trouble, since most people hesitate before taking bold action, even when action is what is required, single-minded self-assurance will make you the focus of attention. People will believe in you through the simple force of your character. When Franklin Delano Roosevelt came to power amidst the Depression, much of the public had little faith he could turn things around. But in his first few months in office, he displayed such confidence, such decisiveness and clarity in dealing with the country's many problems, that the public began to see him as their savior, someone with intense charisma. Mystery. Mystery lies at charisma's heart, but it is a particular kind of mystery, a mystery expressed by contradiction. The charismatic may be both proletarian and aristocratic, Mao Zedong, both cruel and kind, Peter the Great, both excitable and icily detached, Charles de Gaulle, both intimate and distant, Sigmund Freud. Since most people are predictable, the effect of these contradictions is devastatingly charismatic. They make you hard to fathom, add richness to your character, make people talk about you. It's often better to reveal your contradictions slowly and subtly. If you throw them out one on top of the other, people may think you have an erratic personality. Show your mysteriousness gradually, and word will spread. You must also keep people at arm's length to keep them from figuring you out. Another aspect of mystery is a hint of the uncanny. The appearance of prophetic or psychic gifts will add to your aura. Predict things authoritatively, and people will often imagine that what you have said has come true. Saintliness. Most of us must compromise constantly to survive. Saints do not. They must live out their ideals without caring about the consequences. The saintly effect bestows charisma. Saintliness goes far beyond religion. Politicians as disparate as George Washington and Lenin won saintly reputations by living simply, despite their power, by matching their political values to their personal lives. Both men were virtually deified after they died. Albert Einstein, too, had a saintly aura, childlike, unwilling to compromise, lost in his own world. The key is that you must already have some deeply held values. That part cannot be faked, at least not without risking accusations of charlatanry that will destroy your charisma in the long run. The next step is to show, as simply and subtly as possible, that you live what you believe. Finally, the appearance of being mild and unassuming can eventually turn into charisma, as long as you seem completely comfortable with it. The source of Harry Truman's charisma, and even of Abraham Lincoln's, was to appear to be an everyman. Eloquence. A charismatic relies on the power of words. The reason is simple. Words are the quickest way to create emotional disturbance. They can uplift, elevate, stir anger without referring to anything real. During the Spanish Civil War, Dolores Gómez Ibárruri, known as La Pasionaria, gave pro-communist speeches that were so emotionally powerful as to determine several key moments in the war. To bring off this kind of eloquence, it helps if the speaker is as emotional, as caught up in words, as the audience is. Yet eloquence can be learned. The devices La Pasionaria used, catchwords, slogans, rhythmic repetitions, phrases for the audience to repeat, can easily be acquired. Roosevelt, a calm patrician type, was able to make himself a dynamic speaker, both through his style of delivery, which was slow and hypnotic, and through his brilliant use of imagery, alliteration, and biblical rhetoric. The crowds at his rallies were often moved to tears. The slow, authoritative style is often more effective than passion in the long run, for it's more subtly spellbinding and less tiring. Theatricality. A charismatic is larger than life, has extra presence. Actors have studied this kind of presence for centuries. They know how to stand on a crowded stage and command attention. Surprisingly, it's not the actor who screams the loudest or gestures the most wildly who works this magic best, but the actor who stays calm, radiating self-assurance. The effect is ruined by trying too hard. It is essential to be self-aware, to have the ability to see yourself as others see you. De Gaulle understood that self-awareness was key to his charisma. In the most turbulent circumstances, the Nazi occupation of France, the National Reconstruction after World War II, an army rebellion in Algeria, he retained an Olympian composure that played beautifully against the hysteria of his colleagues. When he spoke, no one could take their eyes off him. Once you know how to command attention this way, heighten the effect by appearing in ceremonial and ritual events that are full of exciting imagery, making you look regal and godlike. Flamboyancy has nothing to do with charisma. It attracts the wrong kind of attention. Uninhibitedness. Most people are repressed and have little access to their unconscious, a problem that creates opportunities for the charismatic, who can become a kind of screen on which others project their secret fantasies and longings. You will first have to show that you are less inhibited than your audience, that you radiate a dangerous sexuality, have no fear of death, are delightfully spontaneous. Even a hint of these qualities will make people think you are more powerful than you are. In the 1850s, a Bohemian American actress, Ada Isaacs Menken, took the world by storm through her unbridled sexual energy and her fearlessness. She would appear on stage, half naked, performing death-defying acts. Few women could dare such things in the Victorian period, and a rather mediocre actress became a figure of cult-like adoration. An extension of your being uninhibited is a dreamlike quality in your work and character that reveals your openness to your unconscious. It was the possession of this quality that transformed artists like Wagner and Picasso into charismatic idols. Its cousin is a fluidity of body and spirit, while the repressed are rigid, charismatics have an ease and an adaptability that show their openness to experience. Fervency. You need to believe in something, and to believe in it strongly enough for it to animate all your gestures and make your eyes light up. This cannot be faked. Politicians inevitably lie to the public. What distinguishes charismatics is that they believe their own lies, which makes them that much more believable. A prerequisite for fiery belief is some great cause to rally around, a crusade. Become the rallying point for people's discontent and show that you share none of the doubts that plague normal humans. In 1490, the Florentine Girolamo Savonarola railed at the immorality of the Pope and the Catholic Church. Claiming to be divinely inspired, he became so animated during his sermons that hysteria would sweep the crowd. Savonarola developed such a following that he briefly took over the city until the Pope had him captured and burned at the stake. People believed in him because of the depth of his conviction. His example has more relevance today than ever. People are more and more isolated and long for communal experience. Let your own fervent and contagious faith in virtually anything give them something to believe in. Vulnerability. Charismatics display a need for love and affection. They are open to their audience and, in fact, feed off its energy. The audience, in turn, is electrified by the charismatic, the current increasing as it passes back and forth. This vulnerable side to charisma softens the self-confident side, which can seem fanatical and frightening. Since charisma involves feelings akin to love, you, in turn, must reveal your love for your followers. This was a key component to the charisma that Marilyn Monroe radiated on camera. "I knew I belonged to the public," she wrote in her diary, "and to the world, not because I was talented or even beautiful, but because I had never belonged to anything or anyone else. The public was the only family, the only Prince Charming, and the only home I had ever dreamed of." In front of a camera, Monroe suddenly came to life, flirting with and exciting her unseen public. If the audience doesn't sense this quality in you, they will turn away from you. On the other hand, you must never seem manipulative or needy. Imagine your public as a single person whom you are trying to seduce. Nothing is more seductive to people than the feeling that they are desired. Adventurousness. Charismatics are unconventional. They have an air of adventure and risk that attracts the bored. Be brazen and courageous in your actions. Be seen taking risks for the good of others. Napoleon made sure his soldiers saw him at the cannons in battle. Lenin walked openly on the streets despite the death threats he had received. Charismatics thrive in troubled waters. A crisis situation allows them to flaunt their daring, which enhances their aura. John F. Kennedy came to life in dealing with the Cuban Missile Crisis. Charles de Gaulle when he confronted rebellion in Algeria. They needed these problems to seem charismatic, and in fact, some have even accused them of stirring up situations, Kennedy, through his brinkmanship style of diplomacy, for instance, that played to their love of adventure. Show heroism, to give yourself a charisma that will last you a lifetime. Conversely, the slightest sign of cowardice or timidity will ruin whatever charisma you had. Magnetism. If any physical attribute is crucial in seduction, it is the eyes. They reveal excitement, tension, detachment, without a word being spoken. Indirect communication is critical in seduction and also in charisma. The demeanor of charismatics may be poised and calm, but their eyes are magnetic. They have a piercing gaze that disturbs their target's emotions, exerting force without words or action. Fidel Castro's aggressive gaze can reduce his opponents to silence. When Benito Mussolini was challenged, he would roll his eyes, showing the whites in a way that frightened people. President Kusnasosro Sukarno of Indonesia had a gaze that seemed as if it could have read thoughts. Roosevelt could dilate his pupils at will, making his stare both hypnotizing and intimidating. The eyes of the charismatic never show fear or nerves. All of these skills are acquirable. Napoleon spent hours in front of a mirror, modeling his gaze on that of the great contemporary actor Talma. The key is self-control. The look doesn't necessarily have to be aggressive. It can also show contentment. Remember, your eyes can emanate charisma, but they can also give you away as a faker. Do not leave such an important attribute to chance. Practice the effect you desire. Charismatic types, historical examples. The Miraculous Prophet. In the year 1425, Joan of Arc, a peasant girl from the French village of Domremy, had her first vision. I was in my 13th year when God sent a voice to guide me. The voice was that of Saint Michael, and he came with a message from God. Joan had been chosen to rid France of the English invaders who now ruled most of the country, and of the resulting chaos and war. She was also to restore the French crown to the prince, the Dauphin, later Charles VII, who was its rightful heir. Saint Catherine and Saint Margaret also spoke to Joan. Her visions were extraordinarily vivid. She saw Saint Michael, touched him, smelled him. At first, Joan told no one what she had seen. For all anyone knew, she was a quiet farm girl. But the visions became even more intense, and so in 1429 she left Domremy, determined to realize the mission for which God had chosen her. Her goal was to meet Charles in the town of Chinon, where he had established his court in exile. The obstacles were enormous. Chinon was far. The journey was dangerous, and Charles, even if she reached him, was a lazy and cowardly young man who was unlikely to crusade against the English. Undaunted, she moved from village to village, explaining her mission to soldiers and asking them to escort her to Chinon. Young girls with religious visions were a dime a dozen at the time, and there was nothing in Joan's appearance to inspire confidence. One soldier, however, Jean de Mez, was intrigued with her. What fascinated him was the detail of her visions. She would liberate the besieged town of Orléans, have the king crowned at the cathedral in Reims, lead the army to Paris. She knew how she would be wounded and where. The words she attributed to Saint Michael were quite unlike the language of a farm girl, and she was so calmly confident she glowed with conviction. De Metz fell under her spell. He swore allegiance and set out with her for Chinon. Soon others offered assistance too, and word reached Charles of the strange young girl on her way to meet him. On the 350-mile road to Chinon, accompanied only by a handful of soldiers, through a land infested with warring bands, Joan showed neither fear nor hesitation. The journey took several months. When she finally arrived, the Dauphin decided to meet the girl who had promised to restore him to his throne, despite the advice of his counselors. But he was bored and wanted amusement, and decided to play a trick on her. She was to meet him in a hall packed with courtiers. To test her prophetic powers, he disguised himself as one of these men and dressed another man as the prince. Yet when Joan arrived, to the amazement of the crowd, she walked straight up to Charles and curtsied and said, "The King of Heaven sends me to you with the message that you shall be the lieutenant of the King of Heaven, who is the King of France." In the talk that followed, Joan seemed to echo Charles's most private thoughts, while once again recounting in extraordinary detail the feats she would accomplish. Days later, this indecisive, flighty man declared himself convinced and gave her his blessing to lead a French army against the English. Miracles and saintliness aside, Joan of Arc had certain basic qualities that made her exceptional. Her visions were intense. She could describe them in such detail that they had to be real. Details have that effect. They lend a sense of reality to even the most preposterous statements. Furthermore, in a time of great disorder, she was supremely focused, as if her strength came from somewhere unworldly. She spoke with authority, and she predicted things people wanted. The English would be defeated. Prosperity would return. She also had a peasant's earthly common sense. She had surely heard descriptions of Charles on the road to Chinon. Once at court, she could have sensed the trick he was playing on her, and could have confidently picked out his pampered face in the crowd. The following year, her visions abandoned her, and her confidence as well. She made many mistakes, leading to her capture by the English. She was indeed human. We may no longer believe in miracles, but anything that hints at strange, unworldly, even supernatural powers will create charisma. The psychology is the same. You have visions of the future and of the wondrous things you can accomplish. Describe these things in great detail, with an air of authority, and suddenly you stand out. And if your prophecy of prosperity, say, is just what people want to hear, they are likely to fall under your spell and to see later events as a confirmation of your predictions. Exhibit remarkable confidence, and people will think your confidence comes from real knowledge. You will create a self-fulfilling prophecy. People's belief in you will translate into actions that help realize your visions. Any hint of success will make them see miracles, uncanny powers, the glow of charisma. The Authentic Animal. One day in 1905, the St. Petersburg salon of Countess Ignatieff was unusually full. Politicians, society ladies, and courtiers had all arrived early to await the remarkable guest of honor. Grigory Efimovich Rasputin, a 40-year-old Siberian monk who had made a name for himself throughout Russia as a healer, perhaps a saint. When Rasputin arrived, few could disguise their disappointment. His face was ugly, his hair was stringy, he was gangly and awkward. They wondered why they had come. But then Rasputin approached them one by one, wrapping his big hands around their fingers and gazing deep into their eyes. At first his gaze was unsettling. As he looked them up and down, he seemed to be probing and judging them. Yet suddenly his expression would change, and kindness, joy, and understanding would radiate from his face. Several of the ladies he actually hugged in a most effusive manner. This startling contrast had profound effects. The mood in the salon soon changed from disappointment to excitement. Rasputin's voice was so calm and deep. His language was coarse, yet the ideas it expressed were delightfully simple and had the ring of great spiritual truth. Then, just as the guests were beginning to relax with this dirty-looking peasant, his mood suddenly changed to anger. He said, I know you. I can read your souls. You are all too pampered. These fine clothes and arts of yours are useless and pernicious. Men must learn to humble themselves. You must be simpler, far, far simpler. Only then will God come nearer to you." The monk's face grew animated. His pupils expanded. He looked completely different. How impressive that angry look was, recalling Jesus throwing the moneylenders from the temple. Now Rasputin calmed down, returned to being gracious. But the guests already saw him as someone strange and remarkable. Next, in a performance he would soon repeat in salons throughout the city, he led the guests in a folk song. And as they sang, he began to dance, a strange, uninhibited dance of his own design. And as he danced, he circled the most attractive women there and with his eyes invited them to join him. The dance turned vaguely sexual. As his partners fell under his spell, he whispered suggestive comments in their ears, yet none of them seemed to be offended. Over the next few months, women from every level of St. Petersburg society visited Rasputin in his apartment. He would talk to them of spiritual matters, but then without warning, he would turn sexual, murmuring the crassest come-ons. He would justify himself through spiritual dogma. How can you repent if you have not sinned? Salvation only comes to those who go astray. One of the few who rejected his advances was asked by a friend, "How can one refuse anything to a saint?" "Does a saint need sinful love?" she replied. Her friend said, "He makes everything that comes near him holy. I have already belonged to him, and I am proud and happy to have done so." "But you are married. What does your husband say?" "He considers it a very great honor. If Rasputin desires a woman, we all think it a blessing and a distinction, our husbands as well as ourselves." Rasputin's spell soon extended over Tsar Nicholas, and more particularly over his wife, the Tsarina Alexandra. After he apparently healed their son from a life-threatening injury. Within a few years, he had become the most powerful man in Russia, with total sway over the royal couple. People are more complicated than the masks they wear in society. The man who seems so noble and gentle is probably disguising a dark side, which will often come out in strange ways. If his nobility and refinement are in fact a put-on, sooner or later the truth will come out, and his hypocrisy will disappoint and alienate. On the other hand, we are drawn to people who seem more comfortably human, who don't bother to disguise their contradictions. This was the source of Rasputin's charisma. A man so authentically himself, so devoid of self-consciousness or hypocrisy, was immediately appealing. His wickedness and saintliness were so extreme that it made him seem larger than life. The result was a charismatic aura that was immediate and pre-verbal. It radiated from his eyes and from the touch of his hands. Most of us are a mix of the devil and the saint, the noble and the ignoble, and we spend our lives trying to repress the dark side. Few of us can give free rein to both sides, as Rasputin did, but we can create charisma to a smaller degree by ridding ourselves of self-consciousness and of the discomfort most of us feel about our complicated natures. You cannot help being the way you are, so be genuine. That is what attracts us to animals. Beautiful and cruel, they have no self-doubt. That quality is doubly fascinating in humans. Outwardly, people may condemn your dark side, but it is not virtue alone that creates charisma. Anything extraordinary will do. Do not apologize or go halfway. The more unbridled you seem, the more magnetic the effect. The demonic performer. Throughout his childhood, Elvis Presley was thought a strange boy who kept pretty much to himself. In high school in Memphis, Tennessee, he attracted attention with his pompadoured hair and sideburns, his pink and black clothing. But people who tried to talk to him found nothing there. He was either terribly bland or hopelessly shy. At the high school prom, he was the only boy who didn't dance. He seemed lost in a private world, in love with the guitar he took everywhere. At the Ellis Auditorium, at the end of an evening of gospel music or wrestling, the concessions manager would often find Elvis on stage, miming a performance and taking bows before an imaginary audience. Asked to leave, he would quietly walk away. He was a very polite young man. In 1953, just out of high school, Elvis recorded his first song in a local studio. The record was a test, a chance for him to hear his own voice. A year later, the owner of the studio, Sam Phillips, called him in to record two blues songs with a couple of professional musicians. They worked for hours, but nothing seemed to click. Elvis was nervous and inhibited. Then, near the end of the evening, giddy with exhaustion, he suddenly let loose and started to jump around like a child in a moment of complete self-abandon. The other musicians joined in, the song getting wilder and wilder. Phillips's eyes lit up. He had something here. A month later, Elvis gave his first public performance outdoors in a Memphis park. He was as nervous as he had been at the recording session and could only stutter when he had to speak. But once he broke into song, the words came out. The crowd responded excitedly, rising to peaks at certain moments. Elvis couldn't figure out why. "I went over to the manager after the song," he later said, "and I asked him what was making the crowd go nuts. He told me, 'I'm not really sure, but I think that every time you wiggle your left leg, they start to scream. Whatever it is, just don't stop.'" A single Elvis recorded in 1954 became a hit. Soon, he was in demand. Going on stage filled him with anxiety and emotion, so much so that he became a different person, as if possessed. "I've talked to some singers, and they get a little nervous, but they say their nerves kind of settle down after they get into it. Mine never do. It's sort of this energy, something maybe like sex," he said. Over the next few months, he discovered more gestures and sounds, twitching dance movements, a more tremulous voice that made the crowds go crazy, particularly teenage girls. Within a year, he had become the hottest musician in America. His concerts were exercises in mass hysteria. Elvis Presley had a dark side, a secret life. Some have attributed it to the death at birth of his twin brother. This dark side he deeply repressed as a young man. It included all kinds of fantasies which he could only give into when he was alone, although his unconventional clothing may also have been a symptom of it. When he performed, though, he was able to let these demons loose. They came out as a dangerous sexual power. Twitching, androgynous, uninhibited, he was a man enacting strange fantasies before the public. The audience sensed this and was excited by it. It wasn't a flamboyant style and appearance that gave Elvis charisma, but rather the electrifying expression of his inner turmoil. A crowd or group of any sort has a unique energy. Just below the surface is desire, a constant sexual excitement that has to be repressed because it is socially unacceptable. If you have the ability to rouse those desires, the crowd will see you as having charisma. The key is learning to access your own unconscious, as Elvis did when he let go. You are full of an excitement that seems to come from some mysterious inner source. Your uninhibitedness will invite other people to open up, sparking a chain reaction. Their excitement, in turn, will animate you still more. The fantasies you bring to the surface don't have to be sexual. any social taboo, anything repressed and yearning for an outlet will suffice. Make this felt in your recordings, your artwork, your books. Social pressure keeps people so repressed that they will be attracted to your charisma before they have even met you in person. The Savior. In March of 1917, the Russian Parliament forced the country's ruler, Tsar Nicholas, to abdicate and established a provisional government. Russia was in ruins. Its participation in World War I had been a disaster. Famine was spreading widely. The vast countryside was riven by looting and lynch law, and soldiers were deserting from the army en masse. Politically, the country was bitterly divided. The main factions were the right, the social democrats, and the left-wing revolutionaries, and each of these groups was itself afflicted by dissension. Into this chaos came the 47-year-old Vladimir Ilyich Lenin. A Marxist revolutionary, the leader of the Bolshevik Communist Party, he had suffered a 12-year exile in Europe until, recognizing the chaos overcoming Russia as the chance he had long been waiting for, he had hurried back home. Now he called for the country to end its participation in the war and for an immediate socialist revolution. In the first weeks after his arrival, nothing could have seemed more ridiculous. As a man, Lenin looked unimpressive. He was short and plain-featured. He had also spent years away in Europe, isolated from his people and immersed in reading and intellectual argument. Most important, his party was small, representing only a splinter group within the loosely organized left coalition. Few took him seriously as a national leader. Undaunted, Lenin went to work. Wherever he went, he repeated the same simple message: end the war, establish the rule of the proletariat, abolish private property, redistribute wealth. Exhausted with the nation's endless political infighting and the complexity of its problems, people began to listen. Lenin was so determined, so confident. He never lost his cool. In the midst of a raucous debate, he would simply and logically debunk each one of his adversaries' points. Workers and soldiers were impressed by his firmness. Once, in the midst of a brewing riot, Lenin amazed his chauffeur by jumping onto the running board of his car and directing the way through the crowd, at considerable personal risk. Told that his ideas had nothing to do with reality, he would answer, "So much the worse for reality." Allied to Lenin's messianic confidence in his cause was his ability to organize. Exiled in Europe, his party had been scattered and diminished. In keeping them together, he had developed immense practical skills. In front of a large crowd, he was also a powerful orator. His speech at the first All-Russian Soviet Congress made a sensation. "Either revolution or a bourgeois government," he cried, "but nothing in between. Enough of this compromise in which the left was sharing." At a time when other politicians were scrambling desperately to adapt to the national crisis and seemed weak in the process, Lenin was rock stable. His prestige soared, as did the membership of the Bolshevik Party. Most astounding of all was Lenin's effect on workers, soldiers, and peasants. He would address these common people wherever he found them, in the street, standing on a chair, his thumbs in his lapel, his speech an odd mix of ideology, peasant aphorisms, and revolutionary slogans. They would listen enraptured. When Lenin died in 1924, 7 years after single-handedly opening the way to the October Revolution of 1917, which had swept him and the Bolsheviks into power, these same ordinary Russians went into mourning. They worshipped at his tomb, where his body was preserved on view. They told stories about him, developing a body of Lenin folklore. Thousands of newborn girls were christened Ninel. Lenin spelled backwards. This cult of Lenin assumed religious proportions. There are all kinds of misconceptions about charisma, which paradoxically only add to its mystique. Charisma has little to do with an exciting physical appearance or colorful personality, qualities that elicit short-term interest. Particularly in times of trouble, people aren't looking for entertainment. They want security, a better quality of life, social cohesion. Believe it or not, a plain-looking man or woman with a clear vision, a quality of single-mindedness, and practical skills can be devastatingly charismatic, provided it is matched with some success. Never underestimate the power of success in enhancing one's aura. But in a world teeming with compromisers and fudgers, whose indecisiveness only creates more disorder, one clear-minded soul will be a magnet of attention, will have charisma. One-on-one, or in a Zurich cafe before the revolution, Lenin had little or no charisma. His confidence was attractive, but many found his strident manner irritating. He won charisma when he was seen as the man who could save the country. Charisma is not a mysterious quality that inhabits you outside your control. It is an illusion in the eyes of those who see you as having what they lack. Particularly in times of trouble, you can enhance that illusion through calmness, resolution, and clear-minded practicality. It also helps to have a seductively simple message. Call it the savior syndrome. Once people imagine you can save them from chaos, they will fall in love with you like a person who melts in the arms of his or her rescuer. And mass love equals charisma. How else to explain the love ordinary Russians felt for a man as emotionless and unexciting as Vladimir Lenin? The Guru. According to the beliefs of the Theosophical Society, every 2,000 years or so, the spirit of the world teacher, Lord Maitreya, inhabits the body of a human. First, there was Sri Krishna, born 2,000 years before Christ. Then there was Jesus himself, and at the start of the 20th century, another incarnation was due. One day in 1909, the Theosophist Charles Leadbeater saw a boy on an Indian beach and had an epiphany. This 14-year-old lad, Jiddu Krishnamurti, would be the world teacher's next vehicle. Leadbeater was struck by the simplicity of the boy, who seemed to lack the slightest trace of selfishness. The members of the Theosophical Society agreed with his assessment and adopted this scraggly, underfed youth, whose teachers had repeatedly beaten him for stupidity. They fed and clothed him and began his spiritual instruction. The scruffy urchin turned into a devilishly handsome young man. In 1911, the Theosophists formed the Order of the Star in the East, a group intended to prepare the way for the coming of the world teacher. Krishnamurti was made head of the order. He was taken to England, where his education continued, and everywhere he went he was pampered and revered. His air of simplicity and contentment couldn't help but impress. Soon, Krishnamurti began to have visions. In 1922, he declared, quote, "I have drunk at the fountain of joy and eternal beauty. I am God intoxicated," unquote. Over the next few years, he had psychic experiences that the Theosophists interpreted as visits from the world teacher. But Krishnamurti had actually had a different kind of revelation. The truth of the universe came from within. No God, no guru, no dogma could ever make one realize it. He himself was no God or Messiah, but just another man. The reverence that he was treated with disgusted him. In 1929, much to his followers' shock, he disbanded the Order of the Star and resigned from the Theosophical Society. And so Krishnamurti became a philosopher, determined to spread the truth he had discovered. You must be simple. removing the screen of language and past experience. Through these means, anyone could attain contentment of the kind that radiated from Krishnamurti. The Theosophists abandoned him, but his following grew larger than ever. In California, where he spent much of his time, the interest in him verged on cultic adoration. The poet Robinson Jeffers said that whenever Krishnamurti entered a room, you could feel a brightness filling the space. The writer Aldous Huxley met him in Los Angeles and fell under his spell. Hearing him speak, he wrote, quote, "It was like listening to the discourse of the Buddha. Such power, such intrinsic authority," unquote. The man radiated enlightenment. The actor John Barrymore asked him to play the role of Buddha in a film. Krishnamurti politely declined. When he visited India, hands would reach out from the crowd to try to touch him through the open car window. People prostrated themselves before him. Repulsed by all this adoration, Krishnamurti grew more and more detached. He even talked about himself in the third person. In fact, the ability to disengage from one's past and view the world anew was part of his philosophy, yet once again, the effect was the opposite of what he expected. The affection and reverence people felt for him only grew. His followers fought jealously for signs of his favor. Women, in particular, fell deeply in love with him, although he was a lifelong celibate. Krishnamurti had no desire to be a guru or a charismatic, but he inadvertently discovered a law of human psychology that disturbed him. People don't want to hear that your power comes from years of effort or discipline. They prefer to think that it comes from your personality, your character, something you were born with. They also hope that proximity to the guru or charismatic will make some of that power rub off on them. They didn't want to have to read Krishnamurti's books or to spend years practicing his lessons. They simply wanted to be near him, soak up his aura, hear him speak, feel the light that entered the room with him. Krishnamurti advocated simplicity as a way of opening up to the truth, but his own simplicity just allowed people to see what they wanted in him, attributing powers to him that he not only denied, but ridiculed. This is the guru effect, and it is surprisingly simple to create. The aura you are after is not the fiery one of most charismatics, but one of incandescence, enlightenment. An enlightened person has understood something that makes him or her content, and this contentment radiates outward. That is the appearance you want. You don't need anything or anyone. You are fulfilled. People are naturally drawn to those who emit happiness. Maybe they can catch it from you. The less obvious you are, the better. Let people conclude that you're happy rather than hearing it from you. Let them see it in your unhurried manner, your gentle smile, your ease and comfort. Keep your words vague, letting people imagine what they will. Remember, being aloof and distant only stimulates the effect. People will fight for the slightest sign of your interest. A guru is content and detached. A deadly charismatic combination. The Drama Saint. It began on the radio. Throughout the late 1930s and early 1940s, Argentine women would hear the plaintive musical voice of Eva Duarte in one of the lavishly produced soap operas that were so popular at the time. She never made you laugh, but how often she could make you cry with the complaints of a betrayed lover or the last words of Marie Antoinette. The very thought of her voice made you shiver with emotion, and she was pretty, with her flowing blonde hair and her serious face, which was often on the covers of the gossip magazines. In 1943, those magazines published a most exciting story. Eva had begun an affair with one of the most dashing men in the new military government, Colonel Juan Perón.
Now Argentines heard her doing propaganda spots for the government, lauding the new Argentina that glistened in the future. And finally, this fairy tale story reached its perfect conclusion. In 1945, Juan and Eva married. And the following year, the handsome colonel, after many trials and tribulations, including a spell in prison from which he was freed by the efforts of